둘, 셋, 파!
Borahe Army and fellow music fans, I'm Kayla.
And I'm Bethany, and we're the hosts of Standing BTS from the Consequence Podcast Network. We're a bi-weekly show that covers the impact and legacy of K-pop group BTS.
We mix the perfect blend of research and fangirl as we take a deep dive into lyrics during album reviews, theorize over music videos, and keep up with their current events.
No BTS topic is off limits. We welcome everyone into the conversation, whether you're a casual fan, committed ARMY, or someone who's just curious about one of the biggest music groups in the world.
Come chat with us every other Thursday with a new episode wherever podcasts are found.
Ladies and gentlemen, we are now boarding Group A. Please have your boarding passes ready to scan. If your phone is cracked, old, or was chewed up by your Chihuahua travel companion, please refrain from holding up the line. Instead, go to Verizon and trade in any phone in any condition from one of their top brands for the new Samsung Galaxy S25 Plus with Galaxy AI and a watch and tab on any plan. Only on Verizon.
With new line on my plan. Service plan required for watch and tab. Additional terms apply. See Verizon.com for details.
It's easy to hear your favorite artist on WFPK from wherever you are. Listen on your smart speaker, live stream from our website at WFPK.org from Louisville Public Media.
Consequence Podcast Network.
Welcome to another edition of Kyle Meredith With. It's the interview series presented by WFPK at WFPK.org, Consequence, and the Consequence Podcast Network. Thanks for making your way here for checking out the episode. Please do hit that subscribe button. I put out new interviews just like this one every single week. It's a great way to keep up with your favorite artists. Discover some new ones, too. You can grab us anywhere you get your podcast from, wherever you're listening now, as well as Spotify, Apple Podcast, NPR, WFPK.org, Consequence, YouTube for the video versions, or anywhere you get your podcast from. You can subscribe to Kyle Meredith With. Please do give the series a rating and leave a review while you're at it as well. We've had some great guests stop by lately, including David Hornsby and Charlotte Nickdow, to talk about the latest season of Mythic Quest on Apple TV Plus. Jason Isbell was here, blues legend Taj Mahal, members of the Foo Fighters. We had Nadia Natasha to talk about her latest record, the folks from Creedence Clearwater Revival, Peyton List, she's starring in School Spirits and Cobra Kai, Josh Homme of Queens of the Stone Age, just an example of what you get when you subscribe to the Kyle Meredith With podcast. That's me, Kyle Meredith. Today, it's a special Rewind episode, my interviews with Jim Kerr of Simple Minds. Of course, they are the Scottish rock giants who went from post-punk outsiders to stadium-filling anthem makers. With Don't You Forget About Me, they became forever tied to the 80s, but their catalog runs way deeper. Sweeping synths, soaring choruses, a knack for reinvention that's kept them going for decades. Whether they're embracing new wave roots or pushing into new territory, Jim Kerr and the gang are still proving they're more than just a John Hughes soundtrack staple. Our first time that we got to talk was just back in 2018 when they released their record Walk Between Worlds. We got to talk about bridging his current self to his younger self over the record, the overwhelming first time that he went to Abbey Road, and a whole lot more. It's where our journey with Simple Minds begins today. Part one, Kyle Meredith with Jim Kerr.
Hi, Kyle.
Really loving this record, Walk Between Worlds.
Oh, great to hear. That's great.
New album, new songs, a progressed sound as you've done throughout your career, although I get from the press release that there's still like this nice trick of sort of having it rooted somewhere in your past, maybe in the artwork, in some of the hooks. Is that correct?
Yeah, Kyle, I think that's a perennial challenge. You know, it's kind of Groundhog Day with every album. I think if you were to say, well, you know, what would be the ideal scenario here for fans of the band? Well, it's got to be classic, you know. We want classic Simple Minds, which by the very definition means the past. And then you say, what else you want to go? We want to be contemporary. That means now or the future. What's it going to be? But I guess that you want to tick a few of those boxes and you want to get them to sit nicely with each other. And that's what people are hearing on the album.
And I mean, it is a fun thing for a fan too, because, you know, to get these new songs, but to have you call back, like, I've heard that there's one song where you actually sort of hints at older hooks and things like that.
Yeah, well, that was we've got a song called Sense of Discovery that goes back. In fact, it goes back 6-7 years. There's even a version of it online that I did for a radio session or something. But I always felt sometimes a song has to find its time, and it's hard to define why a song's time is now. It's so many things involved, but it felt it was the right time for this song. And everyone around us, the producer was saying, it's great, leave it in, the arrangement is great. And I just kept thinking, well, actually, we're saying it's good. It's good, it's really good. It's good, leave it as it is. And I was going, there's a difference between good and great. And I just had this narking feeling that as much as we had a positive reaction, that something was missing. And they would say to me, well, what is it is missing? And I would say, well, kind of like the thing we had on Alive and Kicking, the what you're going to do things. I say, we need something like that. And in the end, we came up with something that I think evokes that. Yeah. And so it's kind of like a postcard from the future back to the past, or maybe the other way around.
Which is awesome. I sort of get that between the title, too, with the title, with Walk Between Worlds. I wondered about that. Like, is that something to do with connecting with your youth through the present?
There is song. I mean, I think the first song on the album, Magic, is a young guy talking. It's a young, you know, Neil Young. I think he's been modest, but I remember it was a long while ago. He said something about talking about his career, and he says, "What you do when you're young, it doesn't really count." Which, coming from a, because some of the records he made, those young ones, were amazing when he was barely still a kid. I could see the point he was saying. What he was saying is, when you're young, you have nothing else in your life. Some might say you've got nothing to lose. You've got energy to burn. You stay up all night. You're not, you know, you're 100% engaged. And that's what a lot of great work comes out of. However, Neil was saying, fast forward 20, 30 years, when you've been around a bit, you've had a few knocks, you've experienced, you've had other things in your life, relationships, and don't get me wrong, my life has been, by and large, been great. But, you know, no one gets a completely free ride. So to go back to your work when you're in that state is quite interesting what can come out. In our album, the first song, Magic, is the young guy. And the last song, Sense, Discovery, is someone with a lot more experience. And they're both talking about faith, which is kind of abstract if you take it outside of the religious sense. But, you know, the young guy's talking about the faith to believe. He's got this thing in him and he wants to get it out to the world. He believes in magic. He believes everything is possible, all that stuff. And I certainly did when I was younger. The older guy is a bit more tempered. He's still with him, but he's a bit more tempered. And that seems to be the scope of some of the songs.
I mean, when you've got that much to look back on, you know, 40 years, which you guys just celebrated last year. It's interesting to have that foresight and the hindsight and everything that goes into the writing here. It's a cool concept. I'm really enjoying it.
Thank you.
And as far as the sound of the record, I also see, I read that you've sort of laid it out, you know, in the album sense that side one has a sound and side two sort of has a different sound. Is that right?
I would say more... it's more a structure of the songs where we, you know, when it comes towards the end of recording and you've got this, you know, you're shuffling the deck and you're, it's hard now because we were brought up a generation where we were brought up with vinyl and there was two sides and you know, you structured your songs. Now it's quite hard to know how anyone listens to music because everyone listens to it differently and it's all a bit more sliced and diced now. People make their own playlists, but nevertheless, before it leaves us, we have to come up with what we think's a definitive song listing and something that we think gives a narrative in its best way. And when we were doing it, it seemed to us that there was two categories. What turns out to be the first, you know, half of songs there, four or five songs there, the sprightly, young, poppy, very much poppy style songs, very compact, concise arrangements. In the old day, you might have said radio arrangement. And they're very much like that. Whereas the second group of songs, some of them lasting 5, 6, even 7 minutes, much more expansive in concept, expansive in sound. The widescreen sound of Simple Minds, bloody blah. But it definitely felt there was a couple of distinct natures of the beast there.
And these strings at Abbey Road, had you ever recorded there before this?
Well, it's a very funny story because we in our debut album, Life in the Day, we worked with, he's a great producer very much at that time, a guy called John Leckie, who himself had come up through Abbey Road. He cut his teeth engineering and those Pink Floyd records and some of the Beatles things and all that. And John, in his wisdom then, it wasn't his wisdom, on our first album, thought it would be great to us to come down from Glasgow to London. Had never been in London almost. And I think, I don't think it was a week, but we had 5 days in 1979. We'd never made an album. There we were on Abbey Road and that famous room. And the interesting thing was half the band were so inspired by that. And you could understand that. However, the other half, including yours truly, we shrunk because the magnitude of it was, we thought, what does anyone need us for? You know, if everywhere you look around, every tambourine, every mellotron's been used by Pink Floyd and the Beatles, and who the hell needs a record from us, was my thought. So I didn't enjoy it first time round. This time round, it was great, you know, because, yeah, I had the measure of it. And you were getting into this temple, and it is a temple, and this music temple, and working with these, you know, musicians that are from a different world and from a different source of reference and all that, but very enriching, really great.
I mean, like, I always sort of wonder that about how it is, like you know, I've never been there, I've never been over there, and, you know, it's so it still has all that mystique for me, and I sort of wonder when you're more local, you know, when you're in the UK,
it still
holds that weight and the sound of it, it does.
Oh, definitely. Oh, yeah. I mean, that zebra crossing is outside it. And as I said, it's more to do with the nature of the people involved. I remember our bass player, he was like, isn't this the greatest thing ever? I was like, no. It's like, what are we doing here? We'd hardly, you know, I was, up until then, the only time I'd been to London, I was hitchhiking. So, I mean, it was something.
And so you're going to take this out on the road. You're performing the album in full. And I've got to say, that puts a lot of faith in the new work to say, we believe in this thing so much, you're going to hear it from front to back.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's quite a nice turn of events because, let's say, bands of our vintage, more often you get, oh, you're not going to play new stuff, are you? You're only going to play some new stuff, aren't you? Because that's the way of the world. And however, when we handed this over, couldn't believe it. Record company, everyone said, you've got to play this whole thing. It's going to be great. And they had more faith in it than me. They said, you've got to play, you know, you're going to play this. And I said, yeah, we'll play a few songs. No, you're going to play it, surely. It's 8 songs. You can do it. And I mean, the structure, we're doing it, it's only 8 or 9 gigs. In the old days, they were called a showcase, and you would have gone around and, but yeah, we're going to play it and we're going to do a bit of talking about it. And last year we did a tour of our acoustic, we did acoustic versions of our catalogue, and we ended up doing more talking than we thought we would do. And not only that, it got a great reaction because, well, there's things to talk about now and people kind of like it, especially if you can get the right mix of humility and seriousness and humor and be spontaneous and all that as well. And so we're going to do a bit of some question answer stuff as well, play the stuff, but also, you know, of course, we'll start the set and we'll end the set with some songs from back in the day.
Well, I'm envious. I love this record enough, too, that I would love to see it front to back. So, you know, maybe there'll be a video document of it or something like that. You've really outdone yourself.
Oh, good man. Well, there is. One of the shows is getting filmed, and it'll be up on YouTube.
Oh, fantastic. Well, I look forward to it. Jim, it was so great talking to you.
Pleasure. Thanks for the encouragement. Bye-bye.
And we'll be right back right after this.
Shopify is a global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. And sell more with less effort thanks to the Shopify magic, your AI-powered all-star. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/redcircle, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/redcircle now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/redcircle.
What is Dax, are you
tracking all our cars on Carvana Value Tracker on all our devices? Yes, Kristen, yes I am.
Well, I've been looking for my phone for...
In Dax's domain, we see all, so we always know what our cars are worth.
All of them?
All of them. Value surge, trucks up 3.9%.
That's a great offer.
I know. Sell?
Sell.
Track your car's value with Carvana Value Tracker today.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome back. It's Kyle Meredith with Jim Kerr of Simple Minds. And our second time talking was just a year later in 2019, when we got to go on what I called a 40-year journey to discuss the albums Life in a Day, Reel to Reel Cacophony, Street Fighting Years, Our Secrets Are the Same, and Graffiti Soul, all that were celebrating really big anniversaries in 2019. We also got to hear about the beginnings of music that he was making at that time and so much more. So this is part two, Kyle Meredith with Jim Kerr of Simple Minds.
How you doing, Kyle?
What we're looking here is a 40-year quest in hopefully less than a half an hour.
Okay.
But as it happens, I mean, Simple Minds, you released a lot of things on the nines, as it were, you know, 79, 89, and et cetera. And we'll go right back to the beginning, too, because two records in 1979, the first two, Life in a Day and the Reel to Reel record. I mean, this is the 40th anniversary. That's something, right?
Well, you just pointed something out to me, Kyle, about all the nines. I was born on a 59. So
oh, wow.
That's the first nine. but that didn't dawn on me until you just said that right there. So the big year for me coming up this year, but that's the irony, you know. I mean, in terms of attitudes toward anniversaries and things, I'm a guy that normally doesn't even celebrate my own birthday, you know. I don't really care about it. However, as a music fan, and that's what is interesting, not even as an artist, but as a music fan, I still do remember the date of my first concert, and I still do remember certain things all these years later to do with my love for buying records and seeing live bands.
I mean, that's the great thing. I mean, when you get into the science of music and what it does to your brain, how it just time stamps you in this very specific moment throughout your life, you know, and and of course, you know, and I'll pay you that compliment. I mean, I wasn't around yet in 79, but a lot of your music has done that for me. I came just 2 years later for myself in 81.
All right. All right. So you're one of the babies.
One of the babies. That's right. Baby at 37 now, I suppose, but,
Cool.
So Life in a Day, you know, here's where it sort of starts. You know, a couple years into the band's career, you get your first album, and, you know, from how I read history and everything, I mean, everything sort of happens really quickly here. I mean, in the UK, this is sort of a hit right out of the gate, right?
Well, it is in the sense that it, much more than we could ever have imagined. But we were either very lucky, very good, or a combination of a few things. But certainly, when we started our band, our first gig was in 78, January 78. And within a year, we had signed a record deal and we had played a lot in Scotland. We hadn't really played in England, but we had played a lot in Scotland and had built up quite a local following. Big enough, you know, not huge, but big enough so that when our debut album came out, Life in a Day, there was a lot of people in Scotland waiting for it, and they bought it, which put it into the British charts. This made us look bigger than we were in England off the bat. But yeah, within a year we kind of not only did we get a record deal and make a record and well, almost within a year, you know, secured a spot on national TV on the Sirius Music program, stuff that normally would take people 2, 3, 4 years to do. We had got this momentum behind us, and you're right when you say it went very fast.
How were the first days in the studio for you then? Because, you know, again, for having been sort of so new and it's still in a, you know, constant state of flux as far as putting the band together, what were those first days in that studio like?
I mean, tremendously exciting, kind of overwhelming, but tremendously exciting because some of the band had never been in London. I mean, I had traveled to London, hitchhiked to London with our demo tapes and stuff to go around. But I mean, everything was brand new. We couldn't have been greener, but thought we knew it all. So to go down to, you know, to go into, on that debut album, we worked in the best of two or three places in London, all the state of the art at the time, and including, I mean, the cherry in the cake in terms of being overwhelmed was we even had a week in Abbey Road and all of that, which was, you know, beyond dreams. It was tremendously exciting, but it was also, when I say overwhelming, the thinking about it now with hindsight, was it the right thing to do? I'm not so sure it was. It was a huge jump. And to be really honest with you, some of our demo tapes recorded in the little studio along the road from us in Glasgow had a better feel about them. But that's what it was. We wanted a big produced record, and we wanted to work with a big famous record producer, and we wanted to work in the big studios, and we got what we wanted.
And what you all were doing, I mean, sound-wise, it was starting to erupt, you know, whatever subgenre you want to put that in, as everything's been stamped these days. But everything was still sort of new what you were doing, and that's what I love about it. You know, in a post-punk angular world, I mean, this was still virgin territory of how to deconstruct and rebuild a song. I mean, I know you all were looking at certain influences that have been talked about, whether it be Roxy or Bowie or The Doors or something like that, but to me, it seems like even touching on those artists, it was still just going out into the darkness with your songwriting. Like, how did you all find that?
Well, that's a great question. I mean, I was actually talking today to my songwriting partner, Charlie Burchill, who something came up, and I was saying how we were influenced by very many people, and you just mentioned some of them there, but we weren't very good at copying them. Some people come alive and you can hear, you say, well, that's, you know, that's great, but it's a complete rip-off of something else that came before. We were strongly influenced, but we still had to make it up ourselves. It was still very much homemade. And not only, again, to show you how fresh-faced we were about it all, not only had we never been in London, not only had we never made a record, we had never met anyone who had made a record, because there was no scene in Glasgow. You know, there was no one before us, anyone that from Glasgow who made records moved to London, and you never met them. So we had no mentor, there was no one. It was all done from a distance. It was all through going to see bands playing live. It was all through listening to records, trying to work out what we liked and how you would do it, how you would emulate it, and then how you would eventually create your own thing. And it was all done on the hoof. It was all, whatever you call it now, work, you know, in the workshed. It was just, there was a ton of imagination. That's what there was. There was a ton of enthusiasm, a ton of energy, a ton of imagination.
Well, that must really come into play, you know, as we say, you know, two albums released in that year, which was like the old days, you know, back in the 60s, and there were some bands still doing that, but you know, you follow that up with the album, which released, what, later that year in November.
Yeah.
But that, I mean...
Yeah, well, you were always, by the time an album came out, but you know, you were always working one ahead. So, for instance, by the time we did our debut album, well, we'd already written all those songs 8, 9, 10 months previously, almost. And then by the time the album came out, you were already playing at sound checks. You would be messing around with new ideas and coming up with stuff. So almost by the time a record came out, it was dated to you. You were already on to the next thing. And especially when there was, you know, three or four of the guys in the band who could come up with ideas. There was no shortage of it. It wasn't like it just hung on one or two songwriters. Everyone was coming up with ideas or the momentum, creative momentum. All we did was play music. If we weren't touring, we would be in a rehearsal room playing night and day. When you do that, you're chock full of ideas.
I was going to say, you know, you talk about that imagination, though. I mean, that must have really come into play with Reel to Reel Cacophony because that was mostly written in the studio, though, right? I mean, you were still putting songs together.
Yeah, well, usually, I mean, then you were expected to maybe have 10 songs, and perhaps we would have 5 or 6 up our sleeve, and the rest was kind of left to see what would happen in there, which I don't advise people to do, but that's the way it was then, yeah. And in our case, it worked out.
Yeah, but that's a really big trust fall, especially coming after, you know, some success right out of the gate on that on Life in a Day, as you kind of mentioned, in that way anyway. But to go in there, I mean, there's a lot of trust. Like, this will come. These songs will happen.
Yeah, yeah.
And
yeah, you have to believe.
Yeah, and you're still finding your own voice at that point, right? Because, I mean, it's been written. This is a very different record from Life in the Day.
Yeah, I mean, you see, Life in the Day kind of, I don't want to talk it down, but I had this thing by the end of Life in the Day. I mean, as it was coming out the speakers, you know, in one hand, it sounded impressive. We were in there. It was, you know, produced. It sounded great. There it was. But I didn't have, there was something niggling me about it, and I didn't have the experience to know what it was. It wasn't until a week or so after it was finished where I thought, there's more to Simple Minds than this. This is one aspect of Simple Minds. And so with the second album, I think we tried to pour on more of the art rock. And I think they may have overdone it a little bit because the record company hated it. They really hated it because they wanted songs like Chelsea Girl, you know, verse, chorus, and they, you know, they're great, but you know, we wanted a bit more Brian Eno in there, and so between that, but even the song, even the album title itself, you know, we're hardly looking for the top 10, but we had to show that the band had a depth that perhaps we felt the first album didn't, and that's the path we went down.
When you're still tweaking the lineup, I mean, going into these, how much of that, you know, did you ever find that was an issue in any of your records, you know, as the lineup was sort of always in flux in some way?
That came a little bit later on. I mean, that was still very much, Reel to Reel was still, you know, the original guys that we started out with, really. I mean, actually, we had a few changes before we even made our first album, but Reel to Reel, the first four albums were, you know, still kind of the band from school, because, you know, Simple Minds was formed really from a bunch of school friends. So the first four albums were still around that, and then, you know, you had like the drummer saying, "This is never going to work. I'm going to go and get married and work in my father-in-law's bar and make money there." And we go, "Okay."
Have fun. Enjoy.
Yeah.
So, well, that does, you know, kind of lead in. So let's jump 10 years. You know, now we go to 1989, and it is a very different band, once again, with a very different sound. And we're talking about the Street Fighting years that comes off this one. I mean, would the band from 79 recognize the band from 89, do you think?
That's a good question. No. Probably no.
Probably no. It's a great record, by the way, and I want to compliment that right from the beginning, too, with Street Fighting Years, because I think it did get lost a bit in the era.
Yeah.
But, it's a very political record, and it is, you all once again kind of toying with your sound, trying to find new things to do. And maybe we just start with the beginning of the year, because you release Mandela Day, which I think had been actually done the year before, but it kind of starts off 89 and leads into the record. I mean, is that the proper kickoff? Because we're just coming off of of lots of Mandela talk. We just came out of Russia and the whole world with the Cold War, and now the attention was on Africa, right?
Yeah, I mean, we I guess when we got our big success, you know, really going back to the record before with Once Upon a Time, and we felt, I guess it was just the way we were brought up and stuff. We just felt, also we were growing up, we had much more notice of the world around us and kind of wanted to write about the themes of the day, you know, that these were our times, we felt, and what a challenge. We were interested in the themes of the day, and you just mentioned some of them there. They were the themes that were a big deal to our generation, apartheid, especially in the UK, the whole situation in Northern Ireland, and we wrote Belfast Child about that, and Margaret Thatcher in the UK, there had been a lot of kind of heartless policies that our own town suffered from. So all of that was really fueling the songwriting, which I think if you're going to make every album like that, I don't know. But I think if you're going to make a lot of, you know, music and you have a certain wide-eyedness about the world around you, it's inevitable that you're going to write some of the social songs as people who we looked up to did. Peter Gabriel, Bruce Springsteen, so on and so forth. Even Prince with a song like Sign of the Times, you know, just this little 3.5-minute pop song where he manages to pull all the stuff in. It was really something. It was inspiring.
Every single one of these songs are relevant right now. I mean, because here we are again 30 years later in an age of chaos. You know, once again, as I think, you know, one of your lines about that record has been, you know, it's one of the great things about music, but it's one of the unfortunate things about a record like this, I guess, you know?
Well, funny enough, the interview I did just before, the guy asked me, he said, you know, why don't you feel energized to write songs of a political nature just now? And I said, I guess not. And he said, why do you think that is? And I said, I think we wrote them. I think the issues are always the same. The geography maybe changes. Okay, there's no violence in Northern Ireland just now, but the violence is in Syria. Symbolically, a song like Belfast Child can still work, you know, symbolically. Mm-hmm. Or in 1989, when we saw the Berlin Wall come down and all that stuff, I never thought we'd hear about walls again. Guess what?
And here we are.
You're probably tired hearing about them.
Oh, I'm tired of that man Black speaking Life. At all, for what it's worth.
All right. Black Lives Matter. Well, we wrote about Black Lives Mattering when we wrote about apartheid. It was just a different part of the world. And, I mean, sitting just now, it sounds like I'm being smug saying this. I'm not. It's just that I just feel, I said to him, I feel we've wrote those songs. And I think you're right. It's interesting that you point out that the themes are always really the same if you're going to write about the bigger issues. You know, it's always going to be about injustice. So, I mean, new things come in, you know. But even then, we were working with Greenpeace and all that stuff. The whole ecological movement was moving. It just goes on, and it travels around the world, the geography.
On the lighter side, you know, Lou Reed guests on this record with This Land, and you know, and that sort of ties back in to Chelsea Girl and on the first record, because you know, and you all had that fascination with the Warhol scene. Did that give you access? Were you ever able to kind of dip your toe into Andy's world?
At one point when I was living in London, when I was married to Chrissy Hynde, she was good friends with some of the people that were around that time, Jane County or Wayne County. So there was that, knew David Johansen a bit, but not really. I mean, it was something I felt we grew up with from a distance, but somehow it spoke to us, even though we were teenagers on the other side of the Atlantic.
Well, just to have Lou, you know, kind of be a part of that must have been everything.
Man, come on. It's like getting Picasso or 'cause, you know, to us, that's what he is in musical terms. You know, Lou's, he's a Picasso. And that he would even, that we would start this little band, you know, like millions of others inspired by the Velvet Underground. And then, it's funny, I was writing about this last week because I'm in the process of writing a book, and I was trying to sum up what it felt like to be in a studio in Paris, me, you know, literally waiting for the man. and part terrified because he had a reputation, you know, he could be a bit of a curmudgeon. And, yeah, you know, again, feeling completely out of my depth. What do I say to Lou Reed? But, yeah, it's amazing to think that it all happened.
I just want to quickly hit on the other two nines real quick. One more of a, I'll start with a compliment. Our Secrets Are the Same is the great Lost Simple Minds record. It does eventually come out in a box set. You guys started recording that in 99. I mean, the sort of 90s electronica sound that was going on there is so good. This is one of my favorite records, and I'm not just saying that as one of those nerdy fans who pick the obscure record to say that about. But it's like it's the record to me that what could have been had it all, I guess, worked out in a way, you know?
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean it got lost in many ways, the record. I mean we've never been the type to point the finger to blame at other things or whatever, you know, or even with ourselves, the technology was just coming in then. It wasn't quite all there yet, and the new technology was coming in, and we didn't quite really have it down yet. So I feel the production, mixing, and all that could have been a lot better. But yeah, you know, these were the records. You know, by this time, our popularity was well. We were in Alaska. We were, you know, nowhere. But we had to keep it together. We had to go on. We had to move on. We had to keep creating and not turn in on ourselves, regardless as to. I mean, record was dumped. The record company didn't want it. Which and then we got dumped. You know, they were tough times. But when you look through the history of people, I mean, people much better than us had the same kind of things happen to them, and that's when you find out who you are, and then you go back and you think, you know what, that's a great song, we're going to re-record that soon or whatever. But it does have a charm that I think makes it special.
I mean, you've got a swagger in your vocals that's a really kind of fun to listen to as well on that. I'm a big fan of that one. And then with Graffiti Soul, so that came out in 2009, and that actually has sort of the tie to the present day now, because first off, you know, that was a record, as you say, in, you know, so 1999, there you are on the backside of popularity, but Graffiti Soul puts you back on the charts, and this is a record that's going to get a re-release on Record Store Day, right?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, that was, with Graffiti Soul, we really were starting to show that there was a confidence coming back, and a new vitality, and it was like, okay, we've stopped flatlining. we gotta get off the table and really show, really stand up, and really show that. I mean, I always felt if Graffiti Soul had been a brand new band, I think that brand new band would have got a lot of attention.
Right.
Because I think it's that good. So it was the start of what we look on as a process of rehabilitation.
Well, it's kind of fun that it does tie into the present day. So it'll get the re-release. Do you know what comes next at this point? I mean, the newest record is only a year old, so I don't want to jump too far. But as you say, once the record's done, you're already thinking about that next one.
I was walking around Nice this morning thinking about lyrics and listening to some sketches, and we're already turned the ignition on the new one, or what will be the next one. So it goes on.
I cannot wait for that. Do you start to get a feeling as to what it's going to sound like yet?
Yes. Walking around today, I had a real Bob Clearmount and Once Upon a Time feeling about it.
Interesting.
That's just the way it was. Yeah. I just thought this is evoking for me the kind of joy that was in that record.
Oh, I can't wait for that one. Jim, I'm always such a fan of what you do, and thank you so much for taking this little journey with me today. I so appreciate it.
Appreciate it, Kyle. Thank you very much.
All right. Take care, and we'll be listening.
All the best.
And we'll be right back, right after this. Welcome back. It's Kyle Meredith with Jim Kerr of Simple Minds. Now, the third time in our final stop on this Rewind episode takes us to 2022, when the band released Directions of the Heart, their 19th studio album. Jim got to tell us about reaching into their past for songs like Act of Love, which was the first song they played at their first show in 1978, but had never recorded up to that point, as well as being inspired by folks like Patti Smith, Lou Reed, Television, Talking Heads, and working with Sparks' Russell Mayall, all that and more as we get into part three, Kyle Meredith with Jim Kerr of Simple Minds.
Thanks for having me on, Kyle. Always a pleasure.
It's a pleasure to have you back here, especially with a brand new album. We're talking about Direction of the Hearts. And right from the first single, we knew we were in for something special. And this is such an outstanding record. Congratulations on what you guys have pulled off once again.
Thank you very much. Take that encouragement. That's a lovely compliment. Yeah, we've been getting a lot of compliments about it. And that certainly makes, you never know. You know, you do your best and you never know. But I guess most people you talk to, whenever they put something out, they'll tell you, well, I'm really pleased with it. Well, we are really pleased with this, Kyle. It's a good Simple Minds record.
No, it really is a good, maybe a great Simple Minds record. That's how I'm feeling about it right now. I'm going to throw a broad question out here. Maybe it'll work, but what was the story you wanted to tell with this album? If there was a story, and did it end up being the story that was told?
I mean, I think there's always this thing now where with every new record, there's a sweet spot. I'm not so sure this is a story, but there's certainly a target that you want to hit. And there's a sweet spot that for us is, you kind of want to conjure up the ghosts of the past. And I say conjure up because that's the most you can do. You can't go back. That was then, this is now. The world's changed, you've changed, technology's changed, everything's changed. But there are certain things and certain sounds and a certain attitude that we feel, if we get right, conjures up those early days of Simple Minds. Now, that's great, but we don't just want to be wallowing in nostalgia. We wanted to feel of the moment. We wanted to feel contemporary. Hang on a minute. That's a contradiction in terms. Yeah, well, it may well be. But there is a sweet spot somewhere in there where those two can kind of bridge. And that's what we were hoping we could. That's where we were hoping we could land.
Well, that's really evident, especially when you take a track like Act of Love, which, as I understand, does stretch all the way back to the very, very beginning, next to something called Who Killed Truth. I mean, that is very much something directly to the past and something that we're dealing with right in the present.
Bang on, absolutely. You nailed it there.
Yeah, and they do play together so well. So let me hear about a few of those, because let's start in the past. Let's start with Act of Love. Because once you hear, like, okay, as I understand, like, this is the very first song on the very first set list of the very first Simple Minds show, and somehow gets lost in time, resurrected, rewritten. Why now? What made it finally speak to you?
Well, here's the thing, Kyle. All these years of music, we still, you know, there's always an element of mystery involved, and you're never quite sure why now. You just think, you know what? I can hear this again, but to explain to your listeners, the song in question, Act of Love, Simple Minds played their first ever gig. It was January 17, 1978 in Glasgow, freezing cold night, half empty discotheque, as they used to call those things back then. We went on to the sound of our own feet. And Charlie hit these chords to a song called Act of Love. Now, for years, people have said to me, did you think in the early days that Simple Minds could go on and have the career that you've had? The answer is, of course not. But I tell you what, when Charlie hit those chords that night, I thought, he's got a future. I don't know about the rest of us, because they sounded great then. And I tell you what, they still sound great. But we still, for the next year and a half, playing all the pubs and clubs in Glasgow, trying to get a record deal, trying to hone our act together. We started with this song, Act of Love. Because, you know, it's important when no one knows you. Your first song better make impact, or you don't get a second song in some of these clubs. And it always made impact. It was our banner song. But when it came, a year and a half later to doing our debut album, the ideas were pouring out of us. We had so many new songs and been young and been impatient and been impetuous. We thought, oh, that's old news. And so poor old Act of Love got sidelined. I was thinking, one day we'll go back to that. One day we will go back to that. But lo and behold, a few years ago, probably about 3 years ago, someone, as people want to do, did some sample thing and had it on YouTube, and it was Charlie's Act of Love chords. And God, they sounded great. And it was like, we got to go back to that. Wouldn't that be great to go back with the voice of experience now? I mean, it's essentially the same song, but we strapped on a few engines and we strapped on a better B chorus and all that stuff. So it was really taking this thing, the seed that was planted then, gone back and seeing what we could do with it. And just even the song title itself, Act of Love, you know, people say, you know, you've been making music now, records, 40 years now. What keeps you doing it? It's the love of it that keeps us doing it. So even that, as corny as it sounds, it all felt right.
Do you remember what originally inspired you to write whatever was on your mind back in 77, 78?
I mean, back in those days, you're so, you know, you're drowning in your influences, you know, whatever it was, whether it was Jim Morrison, whether it was Patti Smith, whether it was Lou Reed, or Tom Verlaine, Television, Talking Heads, all those bands that inspired us. We would have been trying to do our version of that.
And we'll be right back right after this. Welcome back. Kyle Meredith with Jim Kerr of Simple Minds. So then let me pull that into the present. You know, that's what you were pulling from when you go into Act of Love all those years ago. Now that you have it here, what does it say to you? How does it speak to the moments?
I'm almost embarrassed to say it sounds great. I mean, we shouldn't be having that kind of energy at this stage of the game. I mean, it just defying gravity there, man, Kyle. It's flying. We not only is it on the record, but we just did a 5-month tour there throughout spring and summer, and we started the set with it every night. I mean, to a lot of the crowd, they wouldn't have known it, as you get with a new song. Do you want to risk starting the set with a new song? When it's got energy like that, yeah, I could see a lot of people say, I don't know this, but I like it. Because it kind of, there are certain songs the energy of it sweeps you up. So that's my impression of it now.
It really does. And it has that moment. You even captured that on the record, which is not, you hear a lot of artists talk about that, right? Like, oh, if we could only capture that feeling that we have live, you know, and it seems like it's a hard thing to do, but those moments are all through this record.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, it is different. I mean, adrenaline's there, life, things are used a bit more out of control and all that, and your heart's pumping a million miles an hour. But you do want to, there's something visceral about playing it live, that if you can keep that, if you can conjure that in the studio, then with bands like ourselves, it's important.
Well, you know, as I mentioned another song in there too, with Who Killed Truth, which is such a poignant moment on this. I don't think we have to think too hard about maybe where the inspiration came from on this one, as it paints it pretty plainly. But, you know, you've done that through your career. You've had very poignant songs that were written about very specific moments in history. When you have a track like this, or any of the ones in your past, I don't know, what does it mean to have a song like that does speak to a moment in history once that moment has passed?
I think there's something about, you know, I mean, there are no rules. You're an artist, you can write about whatever. But for me, I've always liked, among other things, certain artists when they tackle the big themes. When, say, the themes of the day, whatever those are, you know, and of course, the themes of the day, they're always changing as the world's always changing. New language comes in, new catchphrases. I mean, so it's always great if you can be a little zeitgeisty. And if there's, you say, Who Killed Truth, that's a great song to actually, you know, I think we know it's something, especially in America over the last few years, I saw that phrase pop up quite a bit. It could be Shakespearean, though, could it not? I mean, I could hear someone, one of those characters in Hamlet saying, but sire, you know, who killed truth? So it's kind of timeless. It's just beautiful.
If we're talking about song titles and how they came out, what exactly is A Solstice Kiss?
Well, that was just poetry. It really was. I mean, that was the song where our bass player, Jed Grimes, came up with Jed has a real background in Celtic music. And when he came up with the instrumental idea, I mean, you could feel the mists in it. You know, you could feel a bright winter morning. I could anyway. And certainly my job as a lyric writer, I feel, apart from coming up with complimentary melodies, I feel my job is just to try and tell the listener what's the picture in this music. And I could feel a landscape, and I could feel a romance in it as well. It was such a sweet, haunting melody. And so at the time, I guess it would have been about this time of year, I was writing it in Scotland, heading towards solstice, and it just all bled into the song, really.
Now, this one, Solstice Kiss, has a tie-in with an ad campaign for the Spirit of 1926. I watched the little documentary that you guys shot on their website. That's on their website. Was this a song that was written by assignment? I mean, did it come along like that?
No, in fact, it had been written some while ago. I mean, a lot of it, well, actually, we started with like Act of Love, but it was written some while ago, 45 years. That's some while. Some ideas take a little extra time. I would say half the songs we work on, very few do they pop up and they just make it on the next record. Two or three maybe do, those ones that land on your lap. But with a lot of the ideas, they're back burner, and you come back to them again, or there's something great about it. This is great, this is great, this is great. Is it great? Nah, it's good. Big difference between good and great. Okay, what's missing? Sometimes it takes you a long time to find the missing piece. But anyway, I always had faith in it, Charlie a little less so. And just about that time, a whiskey company got in touch. We'd love Simple Minds. Yeah, which Simple Minds do you hear? We hear the Celtic Simple Minds. Oh, we just happen to have one of these lying around here somewhere. Let me have a look in my desk. And then we went at it again.
So if that's the way you typically have written over the years, kind of letting them gestate and it takes a while or whenever they arrive, like how much is sitting in the backlog right now? Like when I'm projecting here towards that next record, whenever that is. You know, and whatever makes it happens to be sitting here, like is there a lot? Is it what you call is that the vaults?
There is a lot, because I'm every couple of weeks I go through again but the true answer to that is I would have to break into Charlie's house and steal the files, because he tells lies about what's there. There's a lot more there than he drip feeds me things. And he'll ask you, what's that? Hang on a minute, what was it? So Papa, you never played me. Yeah, I did play you that. You never played me that. I would know if you played. No. You gotta give me it, and give me all the other stuff that's I'll give you it, but I never get it. So but when we say stuff, I mean, there could be stuff that's, you know, a minute long. And then there could be stuff that's 12 minutes long, but needs to be brought in. But the answer is he's the kind of guy that, you know, he's a natural. When he gets out of bed in the morning, before he's even finished his first, or while he's having his first cup of coffee, he'll be at the piano, or he'll have a guitar around his neck, or that's how he meditates, that's how he thinks, that's how he, and he's, and you know, stuff will be happening, and then he'll record things and then work on them, and then at a certain point, I'll get it, and he'll let me see what kind of sense I can make of it.
It seems like a process that's worked all right for you guys.
It's all right, so. Yeah.
And we'll be right back right after this. Welcome back, Kyle Meredith with Jim Kerr of Simple Minds. I also want to hit on Russell from Sparks is on this. That was such a nice surprise. I'm such a big fan of Sparks too. And what an interesting, and we're talking about the song Human Traffic, you know, melding that you all make together. What's your all's friendship? I mean, does that go all the way back as well? And how did he end up on here?
Well, like yourself, we're fans and we go way back as fans. I mean, again, talking about Charlie Burchill, my songwriting partner, Charlie's big brother Jamie was the cool guy at school. He had records before anyone had, and he had the first couple of Sparks albums when they were on import. And, you know, through their career, what an amazing career they've had, dipping in and out, always been Sparks fans. And the last couple of times we've toured, Russell's came along, and we were thrilled to see him and talk to him. Sweet guy, and but never, you know, exchanged. But that was it. But going back to what I was saying before, that was a case of a song that had been lying around. People who had heard it kept saying, "That's great. You got to go with it. There's something missing. There's something missing." I remember saying to Charlie, "The chorus doesn't make me." And he says, "Doesn't make you what? Dance? No. Punch the air? No. It doesn't make me laugh." And he said, "What are you talking about laugh? We don't do laugh." I said, "But it should be with this song and all the words. It has to kind of, it has to flip. It has to be something comedy." And just as I was saying that, Russell's face was appearing. Not that Russell's any comedy act, but they are hilarious as well.
Very much, yeah.
And I thought, I think I know the guy that could just add a little touch to this. And we were very honored and thrilled that he agreed to do so.
Legends, those fellas right there.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And together, I'll ask about one more song on here because it closes out as a bonus track. I believe it's a bonus track with Wonder Times. It's such a great way to end what I've heard on here. So is that one of the new ones, like the new ones?
The reaction to Wonder Times has been much better than we thought. We liked it, but people who like it really love it. And I think there's something classic Simple Minds about that, and it's somehow it's another one that's almost got a sort of teenage naive hope involved. But go back to Wonder Times. We're going back to, you know, let's be honest. Right now, things are complicated, and when you get this piece of music, it kind of there was something in a great way nostalgic about it, and that's the words that popped up.
Yeah, well, it is a fantastic song again, and a great addition to it. So the one thing I do want to say about my first reaction to this and hearing about how you all reach back and what, especially when we were talking about Act of Love at the beginning here, it just coincided. I, you know, complete coincidence. I was listening to the Neapolis. Did I say that right? That album.
Yeah, you did. You did. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. You know, I always like the anniversaries, and I'd kind of been looking at that anyway because it's coming up on the 25th anniversary. And I don't know if you look at your albums sort of in those connective sort of ways. It's not like these two sound like each other, but that felt like another one. And from what I understand, that you all were in a moment where you're going, all right, how do we recapture some of that youthful energy? I love that record. I don't know if it got its fair due at the time, but I absolutely do love it. I don't know. Do you hear any connective threads that I'm hearing in those?
I tell you what I'm hearing. It's nice that apart from Charlie and I, someone else in the world likes Neapolis. Thanks for that, Kyle. Thanks for that. Yeah, I must say I hadn't thought about that, but certainly at that point in the Apples when I think that, so that was, we were getting it tough at that period. I mean, you know, when you've been a band of, let's say, a band of one generation, and I'd like to think Simple Minds were one of the bands of our generation, you're going to get it in the neck from the next generation coming over the hill with their Nirvanas and their Pearl Jams and their Happy Mondays and their Stone Roses. And anyway, we were finding it tough. We didn't know where we could fit in. But I like that. I like that record. I think, I remember at the time, it was when a lot of the new technology was coming in, and MIDI files and all that stuff, and I think the record suffers a little bit from us not quite knowing what we were doing, but the songs in there, songs like Song for the Tribe, I think is beautiful. So Killing Andy Warhol, loved that as well. But you know, you don't always hit the target, and but sometimes what you can learn from the mistakes or the errors or something that is they are valuable. But it's nice to meet someone else who likes Neapolis.
It's got such a great feel to it, and I do hear the technology that was coming out at that time, because I mean I think that's very really evident. It doesn't, to me, overcrowd the songs, and it doesn't even so much put it in an era. I don't know. I've always just liked the emotion that record makes me feel. But cool. It also says something, like, I think, you know, the life cycle that albums can have, the same way that artists can have. I mean, as you're saying, especially when you get 10 years, right? And then the generation, as you say, the pop culture flips, and the valleys start going like that. And if you stick around long enough, it all comes back around. Somebody starts paying attention again, and then you're back in vogue. And I think that same thing happens with albums, especially now that they're just all online and everybody hears it all at once, you know, an album from 81 and 98 and 2022 all at the same time. I mean, for yourself as an artist, that's, what is that like when that starts to happen in that sense?
I'll tell you what's really interesting. I mean, I am exaggerating a little when I say we're the only three people in the world, the people who like it really love it, but that just a lot of people really like, what was that all about? If you were expecting Don't You Forget About Me, or you were expecting the album that preceded it, Good News from Next World, it, you know, it was such a departure. But, you know, you're damned if you do, you're damned if you don't. You do the same old thing. Oh, it's the same old thing. If you change, oh, what it's changed. But as an artist, you got to go through it. You have to go through the good times and the bad, and you have to go with what's in you, and even then, what's in you can be, if other things in your life at that time maybe are not going so swimmingly, your confidence goes up and down. But certainly with the new record going into that, it was one of those records where every time I walked into the room, I thought, oh, this sounds really good. That's not always the case. Just this sounds really good. I wish they were all like that. This just sounds good.
Well, that's a perfect circle that we've just made there, because Direction of the Heart does sound really good. Jim, I always love what you all do, and I'm so grateful that you're still doing it. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk about this today. It's always an honor.
Good man, Kyle. My regards to you and all your listeners.
And there you have it. Three rounds with Jim Kerr of Simple Minds. Thanks to Jim. Thanks to you for checking out the episode. Hit that subscribe button before you get out of here so you can get all the interviews just like this one sent to you every single week. You can grab a Spotify, Apple Podcast, NPR, WFPK.org, Consequence, YouTube for the video versions, or again, anywhere you get your podcast from, you can subscribe to Kyle Meredith With. And please do give the series a rating and leave a review if you feel so inspired. After that, you can head over to WFPK.org, where I do a show Monday through Friday starting at 6 p.m. Eastern. It's 4 hours of classics from the 80s and 90s. You get the best in new music, bonus interviews, lots of music news as well. One of my recent shows featured some classics and favorites from the Mamas and the Papas, Jim Croce, My Morning Jacket, Supergrass, Bob Seger, Cake, Weezer, Counting Crows, The Lumineers, Brandi Carlile, Sharon Van Etten, and my interview with Jerry Harrison of Talking Heads. That's what you can hear when you tune in weeknights starting at 6 p.m. Eastern at WFPK.org. Consequence has your music and film news. You can also find me on any of the social media sites. The address is always the same. It's at Kyle Meredith. I do hope you like and follow along. That does it for another edition. I'm Kyle Meredith. I'll see you next time.
Consequence Podcast Network.
It's easy to hear your favorite artist on WFPK from wherever you are. Listen on your smart speaker, live stream from our website at WFPK.org from Louisville Public Media.
Your old or broken phone can let you down, but at Verizon, trade in any old phone from our top brands and get iPhone 16 Pro with Apple Intelligence with a new line on MyPlan and iPad and Apple Watch Series 10. After all, you don't want your old phone to die on you when you're lost.
Perfect.
Or for your broken phone to glitch at the worst possible time.
Hey, can I get your number? Oh.
Trade in your old phone for a brand new iPhone 16 Pro, iPad, and Apple Watch. Visit Verizon.com today. Additional terms apply. Service plan required for Apple Watch and iPad.
With the Redfin app, you'll know the moment your next place hits the market. Whether you're looking to buy your dream home or rent a sweet apartment, give Redfin your gotta-have-it wish list of property features, and you'll receive real-time notifications tailored just for you. Ready to see it up close and personal? Scheduling a tour is just a tap away. Don't wait to find your perfect match. Download the Redfin app and start searching today.